T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
The following is a paid program. The views and advice expressed are not that of WWL or Entercom Louisiana LLC. Assessing a person's legal matter often requires extensive interviews, review of contracts and documents, and research of the current state of the law on the issues involved. As a result, the information provided by the attorneys and guests of All Things Legal is given for informational purposes only. It is not to be construed as legal, tax, investment, or other professional advice. Communications with the attorneys on this program, whether verbal or digital, do not create an attorney-client relationship.
Good morning, Doug Cinceri, my wife, law partner, Michelle Demers Cinceri, All Things Legal. Give us a call, 260-1870, or text us at 870-870. Dallas Cowboys, Sunday night.
So. It's going to be a good game.
Thank you, Michelle, for responding to my elbow this morning.
You're so welcome.
And Albert's not here today. Albert's having a 40th year reunion for St. Paul's. I think it might have been they had homecoming this weekend.
Right.
And actually went to the game, second half. I just watched it and saw Slidell beat St. Paul. So Albert is probably recovering from the consuming of adult beverages. And so I'm sure the party ended about 15 minutes ago, and he's probably, easing into bed wherever he's going. But Albert, I have to give him credit. He was the quarterback at St. Paul 40 years ago.
I know. That's exciting.
Albert would, if you describe him as a quarterback, he would be Taysom Hill who couldn't pass.
Okay.
Because, you see, back then, and they didn't have the Archie Manning Passing Academy, where you could take high school quarterbacks and show them how to pass the ball. Now, he was a great runner. I mean, he was great runner. But, they didn't have the Manning Passing Academy. As you know, every summer in Thibodeau, right, a lot of the great high school quarterbacks go, and they got Peyton, Cooper, Archie, Eli teaching, sort of just –
Teaching
him how to pass. Well, unfortunately, when Albert was in high school.
This is never good for Albert.
He attended the J.C. Watson Guido Merkins Passing Academy. And so the older people would remember J.C. Watts. J.C. Watts was the quarterback for Oklahoma, ran the wishbone. He would throw the ball once or twice. And when he did, he would throw it into the stands. But he was a great runner.
So all he did was run.
Yeah, J.C. Watts, he was a congressman. He's a Republican congressman.
I know the name.
In Oklahoma. Yeah, so they ran the wishbone. And so, or Guido Merkins played for BUM, he was their Swiss Army knife at the time. I think he used to punt. He used to have punt returner. He used to play some defensive back, and he was the third string quarterback. In fact, he started a game against the Washington Redskins, I think in 1982 and 1983. When both the Saints quarterbacks were hurt, I think Kenny Stabler and maybe Richard Todd were hurt. And I think he threw for a negative 40 yards or something. So unfortunately.
So that is all a comparison to Albert?
Well, his passing.
His passing.
He was very good. He was a very good runner. But unfortunately, he just went to the wrong passing academies. And now the last thing we heard.
It's a good thing he's probably not listening.
He's not. He's just going to bed right now. But the last thing, too. Is the theory was we didn't know why they didn't pass. It was one of two things. One, he could have been colorblind, and he didn't distinguish the color of the jerseys, so he threw it to the wrong team, or two, he just wasn't accurate. So we're not clear on that. If anybody who played with Albert could clear us up on that.
I'm going to go with the second. I don't think he's colorblind.
So, We've been partners for 28 years,
so we just
I just like him. So Albert, I think Albert's probably just settling into bed from last night, and he'll be up in time for the Dallas game. So Dallas Sunday. So
we're gonna go to the game. It's gonna be a great game.
Did you you'd mentioned on the way to the studio that they started tailgating?
They did. They're out there already.
So we're about 11 hours, a little more than 11 hours from game time in the tailgating. Now, a Sunday night game.
Like it's always interesting.
Well, Monday night games, people work.
Right.
Some people work. So they might get off early, and they might start at 4 or 5 o'clock. But on a Sunday night game, after you come back from church, and after you come back and you say your prayers for the Saints, which is interesting, when you pray in New Orleans, you pray that the Saints are going to win.
And that
Dallas gets their butts kicked, which I think God's very receptive to those prayers. But after that, you have a good 10 hours to get fueled up for the game. So I think by 7:20, New Orleans is ready for game time. It's just a unique Sunday night experience.
It's always unique.
I think it'll be one of those atmospheres that a play, almost like a playoff atmosphere, where a certain excitement, in the sense that how are the Saints going to continue to respond without Drew Brees?
Right.
It's like a new challenge.
Well, and I think last week just gave us, it just gave us a lot of hope. So I think that's
what they did was, and we talked about you had other aspects of the game. Team had to step up, special teams,
right?
Punt return. You had this time. You did have a fumble return for a touchdown where the referee swallowed the whistle, like they were supposed to, let the play out, do the replay, and then. And then they got the touchdown, which was probably the turning point of the game.
Yeah.
And usually the Saints are famous for inadvertent whistles. And we could go on down the line. But it'll be very, very exciting. Dallas is a good team. They really don't have any weaknesses. I mean, they're a lot like the Saints.
What are they? Are they 3-0?
3-0. And they're very they hadn't had a very hard schedule. But Dak Prescott's the quarterback, which drives me up the wall.
I know.
Because Dak is from Louisiana, right? Dak beat LSU when he was playing at Mississippi State. And a certain coach that will go unnamed, who did well in the beginning, but didn't have a great job of getting quarterbacks in toward the end of his tenure. I won't mention his name. His initials are LM. He's coaching at Kansas. And Dak Prescott was in our backyard.
I know.
And
so
we didn't get him.
It's frustrating for you. I know.
But that's okay. That's past. But I'll tell you about how how NFL is part luck and part luck and part a lot of fortune. Because when Dallas was drafting at that time, they wanted a new quarterback. Tony Romo was on his way out. And Dak Prescott was drafted in the 4th round. And Dallas tried to trade up in that draft several times to get quarterbacks who are not even in the league right now. One is Hackenberg. I forgot who the other one was. But they tried to trade up in the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd round, could not do it. So they got to the 4th round and said, okay, we'll take Dak. In the 4th round. And he's all pro. He's fixed. He's about to get probably the highest paid quarterback in the league next year.
Wow.
And then Patrick Mahomes will probably be the highest paid quarterback the following year. Patrick Mahomes is from Kansas City, right, who Sean Payton liked, and Dave, who's the cornerback for the Saints? Lattimore. Thank you. I remember the 1969 roster for the Saints, and I have trouble today in the numbers. But today I'm having a hard time. But Marshawn Lattimore fell, so the Saints didn't take Mahomes, and they took Lattimore, which was you had to do that.
Right.
So Mahomes is probably going to be the first $200 million player in the NFL,
dang,
probably in a year or two. So, but Dak's going to probably go around 150 to 175 with Jerry Jones. So there you go.
Little background.
I could give you additional background on Dallas. You know when was the first time the Saints beat the Dallas Cowboys?
When?
In Archie Manning's rookie year in 1971 in Tulane Stadium. Fantastic game. And that's when they were thinking Archie Manning, Super Bowl. And, in fact, the Cowboys won the Super Bowl that following that year, I think, in Tulane Stadium. And Roger Staubach and Craig Morton were, I think, alternating quarterbacks then. And then we had a dry spell to 1988. And then we finally beat them in Tom Landry's second to last year, 20-17. Bobby was quarterbacking. It was a Monday night game. He threw, he threw about a 40-yard pass with about 10 seconds left to Brent Perryman from, I think, our own 30 to their 30. Perryman caught the ball, fell on the ground, ran out of bounds right before the clock ran out. Morton came in and kicked a 49-yard field goal for a touchdown. I mean, for a win 20-17. Then Jerry.
How do you remember all that?
It's just useless knowledge.
No
research before the show. No. Then the first year that Jimmy Johnson, I think was Troy Aikman's first year. I think they just blew out Dallas on.
When's the last time we beat them?
We beat them a couple. We beat them, I think, 3 years ago. Two years ago.
Thanks, Dave.
Yes. Now we went 5 years ago in Jerry's Dome.
We
lost really bad.
We did. That was not fun.
That's when Tony Romo and they were sort of on an upward trajectory, yeah. And we were sort of floundering at 7-9 at the time. I think that was the year after the first year that Coach Payton was back.
So yeah, I think it
after,
was.
So you know, it's a great rivalry. Mm-hmm. Bobby, our own Bobby.
Do
Hebert,
they travel well?
Yeah, they travel pretty good. Our own Bobby Hebert has got his opinion of the Cowgirls.
I know.
He just, man, when he's Cowboys, I love it. The Cowgirls. Hey, you know.
It says it all.
Well, you know, I liked Coach Landry when he was before. For you millennials, he was the coach of Dallas Cowboys from 1960 to 1989. And he had the hat. He was very calm. Mm-hmm. He was very systematic. And he never got upset on the sidelines, showed no emotions, used to drive his players crazy. And they would say, "What's wrong with you? You don't have a coach. You don't get ruffled. You don't get upset. You're just stoic." He says, "Look, man, I was in World War II. I was 18 years old. I got shot down as a pilot." He said, "After going through that, football ain't no big deal to me.
Yeah, this is just a game.
This is just a game. You know, this is life and death." So, but Coach Landry is great. He was a great, great man. Great. He was a great, great Christian man, and he was wonderful, and he invented. I'm gonna stop here. He invented the flex defense, Coach. I'll give you one more history before we go to a break.
Okay.
When you had the New York Giants in the 1950s, the offensive coordinator for the New York Giants was a guy named Vince Lombardi.
Okay.
And the defensive coordinator was a guy named Tom Landry. And then they both. In 1959, Vince went to the Packers. In 1960, Landry went to the Dallas, I think the Texans. He went to Dallas Cowboys. They were a new expansion franchise. And he had Dandy Don Meredith as his quarterback. And that's a heck of a coaching staff.
That sounds
They had great battles and practice. And Dick Nolan, who coached the Saints, whose son is a linebackers coach, was also on that team.
Wow.
So, last story.
A lot of talent.
All right. Well, let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, all things legal. We'll start talking law in a little while.
Perfect.
But this is a big sports Sunday. We'll be right back after this brief time out. We're back on a Saints Cowgirl Sunday. Now, I'm going to tell you, we sort of transitioned the sports to legal. I learned one of the greatest lessons of my legal career with the Dallas Cowboys.
Do tell.
It really was. It was something I learned, and I think anybody who negotiates anything in the business perspective setting, it was an eye-opening, humiliating occurrence, but. Dallas Cowboys, this is back in my Jerry Maguire days. At the time, the NFL had labor strife, the Bobby Hebert lawsuit.
Sure.
We were in that lawsuit with a couple of players. And they had a collective bargaining agreement.
Right.
The collective bargaining agreement expired. We had the strike in 1987. And then the NFL played without a collective bargaining agreement for a few years. And so then the biggest fear of the NFL was antitrust.
Oh.
Because the NFL is antitrust.
Yeah.
I mean, could you imagine coming out of law school and saying you have to go work in New York or somewhere like, Kansas City
I don't think people think of it like that.
It is, though.
I know.
But you need it to have competitive balance because if you don't, you wouldn't have a competitive NFL because every year any team could make the Super Bowl,
right,
except maybe the Jets. So we were in the middle of that. And so the NFL was scared. And I told a Hale Boggs story about how the Saints came here because of the fear of antitrust and cutting a deal in Congress. But the NFL was sort of concerned about antitrust, so they wanted to get player movement. So they froze the first 37. So the teams froze the first 37 players on each team, and the rest of them are free agents, which was a weird thing because you had no market. So I had one of the players who was unfrozen. And Jerry Jones had just bought the team the January before they had this occurring. And nobody knew the market. I mean, I didn't know. And so I was working with Bill Becknell at the time. Bill put me in touch with Pat Pepler, who used to be the assistant head coach for the Green Bay Packers under Vince Lombardi, and he was the general manager under Bum. So we talked about the player, and I called up Hamp Cook, who was a scout with the Saints, just got his opinion, got a few other opinions as to what the market was. And so what I did was I did my estimate of what the market would be.
And then, if there was collective bargaining?
Well, because he was a free agent.
Right.
So he was, you see, because nobody understood what the 38th player on a team would be the value to other teams.
Sure.
So Jerry was just all excited about buying the Cowboys. And it was very interesting. One component I missed. So I called and I came up with his market. And so what I typically did was I marked it up by about 66%. So for example, if his signing bonus, I thought was his mark was 100, I'd ask for about 150, 160, somewhere, probably about 160. And if his salary would have been 300, I would have asked for 450.
Gotcha.
So I sort of settled on what I was going to ask for and what we would take. And Dallas calling first. And Jerry Jones had just bought the team the month before. And mistake number one, they said, because I was a young lawyer, and I was a young lawyer.
That says it all.
They said, you make the offer first. Mistake number one, when you're in a negotiation, you make the other side make the first offer.
That's right. You keep your mouth closed.
Because a lot of times, that offer may be a lot higher than you think it may be, and you could work off of that.
Sure.
Mistake number one, I made the first offer. So I submitted, I faxed it. Mistake number two, they took it.
You left money on the table.
Oh my goodness. I my heart dropped. I felt ill. I was like, I really blew this. I really, really blew this. And I had to call the player, and I'm like, they accepted our first offer. And he knew. He's like, are you kidding me? He said, you left money on the table. And I said, yes. And so, but the component.
What didn't you take into account?
I didn't assess two things. The biggest thing I did not assess with the Cowboys was the fact that Jerry wanted to remake the team in 1990. He wanted to make it in his own image. So he was willing to overpay for a new group of free agents to remake the team. And I didn't really factor
that
and I didn't factor that into it. And I think the other not mistake, but a lot of the people I asked were thinking under the old NFL system, and I probably needed to think ahead, more futuristic.
Right.
It's not what would his past value would be, what would it be under these new circumstances. But that was a really difficult lesson for me to learn. And my player, I don't think he's talked to me since. So furious with me.
Cut your fee.
No, he was very merciful and forgave me for it. But I think one of the things is in the context of negotiation, I said, you know what? For now on, nobody's ever going to take my first offer. They might laugh at me. They might mock me. They might make fun of me. They might tell me how ridiculous I am. But they're not going to take it because I'm not going to leave money on the table.
Right.
So it was just
one
of those.
We all have to learn those lessons.
One of those interesting life lessons. But you know, Jerry Jones had just bought the team. He was just bananas. I mean, he was so excited. That was his dream, and he was throwing. You know, he had big dreams. Now Jerry Jones also was hated 25 years ago by the owners. Now, for the reason he was hated 25 years ago for the reasons they love him now.
And what was that?
All right. When Jerry Jones took over the team, the NFL had national sponsors that the teams had to accept, maybe like American Express, Visa type deal.
Sure.
So I don't remember the sequence, but I think the NFL might have had Visa or American Express, one of the two, as a national sponsor. And Jerry Jones was like, I'm getting my own sponsors. So he might have the official credit card of the Dallas Cowboys and American Express when the NFL had Visa.
Gotcha.
And the NFL owners went bananas because they're like, this guy's radical. He's just tearing. He's making this league upside down. And he was really upset. And he says, I'm going to, you know, name my stadium against maybe a competitor or have sponsors that compete with the NFL sponsors. And they wanted to sank. They were very upset. They were even, I think, some talk about removing him as an owner. And then as that model progressed, all the other owners realized we can enhance the value of our franchises by doing the same thing,
right?
Which they all do now. And so with the very thing that they wanted to take Jerry Jones out with is the very business ideas that now have these NFL franchises worth $1 billion and more.
Right, because of the marketing dollars and the competitive.
He had a different vision, and there's a lot of criticism about him because when Coach Parcells was there, his position is my team. I'm going to get involved in it.
Yeah.
And a lot of other owners, like I think Mr. Benson was like, I'm just going to be more supervisory. I'm going to let the football people run football, and they just, you know, tell me what's going on, but I'm going to let them do their thing.
Right.
So it's just two competing philosophies, and he was hard to check. Like, in other words, he wanted to pick Johnny Manziel in the draft. What a disaster that would have been.
Oh.
I mean, you know, you had half the Cleveland's administration get fired over that one,
right?
The Browns. So he's just different dynamics. But hey, you know, we want to beat we definitely want to beat the Cowgirls. And but he's in the Hall of Fame now for the NFL. They wanted to run him out 25 years ago. Now he's in their Hall of Fame because of how he remade the business model of the NFL.
I think change is hard for a lot of people, and it's hard for the business world. And so that's what he brought about, is change.
Yeah, he just had a different vision. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of the teams were family-owned, and they just had a certain way of doing things. And the NFL sort of moved away from that, where the owners are more – it's more hot. I don't say hobby, but their livelihoods didn't depend on the teams at the time. In other words, they were able to experiment. Like the Cincinnati Bengals, they had the Brown family that still owns them. And they still do.
Yeah.
And this
I watched a show on SEC that you had taped about three women who own them.
Yeah, that was Lamar Hunt's wife, mm-hmm. Virginia McCaskey, and
yes.
I think it's Pittsburgh's owner.
I can't remember who the other one was. And but they were
Rooney.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, they were very interesting.
One of them, her father had owned the team before.
Yes.
It was interesting.
Well,
stuff.
You know, for example, when back in the 90s and 80s, the Brown family owned the Bengals, and they didn't have a scouting department, which would be unheard of right now. The coaches were the scouts.
So how were they coaching and scouting?
Save money.
Well, I know.
They save money. But that's what the. So, because they didn't want to pay the extra expense of having, you know, scouts or having a scouting department. Yeah, so that's it. So that's
I was just thinking when they're going to do the next one, because then Gail Benson would be on there as the owner. You know, yes. About women.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it was about women-owned.
Yes, that was that on ESPN or NFL? That was on ESPN, I think.
You had taped it. I don't know.
It was fabulously interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Georgia Frontier was probably the first owner. And it's a very interesting story because Georgia was a cabaret singer, and she married Rosenblum, who was the owner.
Yeah.
And Rosenblum drowned. And the president was... Well, the president of the Rams at the time, or who became one, was Jay Zigmont. Now, Jay told me the story. I was like, you were in a CPA working, I think, at Arthur Anderson. How did you become president of the Rams? And I tell accountants this all the time, how, you know, if you're an accountant, CPA, and you're doing auditing, how companies come in and like you, and they ask you to be CFO.
Right.
So he was doing Georgia Frontier's accounting. And they got to develop a very good relationship. He didn't really have a football background at all. And she found out her husband drowned. And she is now the owner of the L.A., well, at the L.A. Rams. And she moved them to St. Louis. And she walked in the office, said, you know, my husband drowned. He says, I know nothing about football. I don't trust anybody. Will you come over and be a administrator for me for the Los Angeles Rams and St. Louis Rams? And then he became the president of the Rams for a long time. So Georgia Frontier, I think, was the first owner, which was sort of interesting that the first owner, female owner in the NFL was a cabaret singer.
So there
you go. Only in America, man. This is a great country. I mean, no other country. You know, all these people who complain about other countries.
Oh, here we go.
You can't have that happen anywhere else. Only in the United States. All right, we're going to talk law. We'll figure out what we're going to talk about after this break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demarest, Cinceri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. All right, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demarest, Cinceri, All Things Legal. She's been tolerating my sports analysis of...
You know, I like it. I sit here amazed at like where all that stuff is in your brain.
I don't have room for much else.
Tapes that all the legal stuff is leaked out.
Yeah, the legal... That's right. Well, you know... Before we go to law, just mention the Tigers. They're off.
I know. We missed them.
Well, they're healing up.
I know.
Michael Divinity's healing up. Yeah. Terrence Marshall's healing up. We've got Justin Jefferson needs to heal up. They play four games, open date, another four games, open date, and they finish the year with four games. So it's Utah State next week. They're probably similar to like playing Southern Miss. Same talent. They should be okay. And 2 weeks, it's Florida.
That's going to be a good game.
Felipe Franks was the starting quarterback. He was he's a coach killer. Got all the intangibles, but he's not any good. And he got hurt. And now they have trash in there. And I think their backup quarterback, Florida, is better than Franks, even though Franks looks great at the national anthem. You know, when he's warming up, he looks fantastic, but he's just not a player. So, you know, that'll be a big, really big test, first SEC test. All right. You know, we're talking about, I thought it'd be an interesting topic, is social media.
It
has really revolutionized
everything.
Everything. And it's also had a profound effect on the law.
It is. You know, I was sitting at a Louisiana LSU loss CLE Thursday, Friday, and it finished up yesterday. And I had a couple of people tell me that one of their requirements when they take cases, and this is family lawyers, is they require their clients to stay off of social media.
Yes.
Like immediately stay off of it. I had one attorney that told me if her client gets back on, she pulls out of the case. You and I were just talking. It's interesting. And what people, and I'm going to call them young people, but anybody doesn't realize is that...
Millennials.
It's not only millennials.
Young people.
If you start deleting texts or any type of posts, under the law, it's called spoliation of the evidence.
And
it can really affect your case.
Yes.
There's been many cases where I've been able to prove stuff with social media, and many cases where my case just went down the tanker because of stuff that was found on social media.
Right, exactly. We were trying a case a couple years ago, and it was a very close issue on timing. as to it was an adoption issue, but it was timing of it was just a timing issue, mm-hmm. and they brought in this mystery witness who started testifying, and I'm asking my client, who is this? And I had a computer, and we found him on Facebook. And he was testifying things that are total on credibility, that could not be substantiated or unsubstantiated. So the judge is just sort of looking at him, trying to figure out if they're telling the truth or not.
Right.
And we found him. And he had two posts. Well, he had many posts. But one of the posts was one of the posts where he's posing with a gun pointing into the camera, you know. And the other post was him smoking dope. And so he went through his big recitation, you know, all the, you know, trying to
than thou.
And then we just pulled out a little computer and we said, is this you? What are you doing there? Who are you pointing the gun at? What are you smoking there? Okay, no further questions.
Right.
And that did it. But that totally undermined that entire trial. And in family law, you have that same issue.
Right. I think, and I guess we'll call it millennials, but I think it's anybody. They don't realize that when you might repost something or like something, and then that very topic or issue becomes an issue in a litigation. That
can
just
be used against
volume.
You. Yeah.
Yes. So I always tell people, you know.
Like, for example, if you have a custody issue and it's hotly contested, and then you have a post at 3:30 in the morning, you know, with your eyes bloodshot, right, you know, with you know, holding up two glasses, you're like, well, you know, what are you doing here?
Right.
You know, just quit. Why even go through this? But, all right, let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Elwin's got a question regarding domicile law. Hey, Elwin, you and all things legal with Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers Cinceri.
I wanted to ask you again because I want to get the understanding of it.
All right.
It's six months they have to stay with you, right?
For
what?
For domicile, for what
domicile
purpose?
Law.
For what purpose?
What is domicile?
If you was on Section 8 and they were staying with you, it would be 6 months before you...
Well, there's different domicile laws under different contexts. They could have domicile laws for purposes of determining the venue of a family law case. They could be domicile laws pertaining to voter registration. They could be domicile law, you know, for in a lot of different contexts.
I think he's talking about Section 8 housing. I think that's what
Yeah, and that's what I was saying.
Yeah. Typically it is 6 months.
Yeah, it's typical 6 months with the intent to...
Let's say if I have a guest staying in my home, which I did, they want to use the domicile law against me, saying that 30 days, if it's 30 days, they could stay. This is their home, too.
Well, that's a question of fact, that what you would have to do is usually when you have a guest who won't leave.
And they were unruly.
Well, yeah. Well, usually if you have a guest that won't leave, the first thing you try to do is ask them to leave and get the police to remove. If the police say no,
the police did not remove them.
That's right. Right. Okay. So if they don't do that, the second step is you do an eviction proceeding. Okay. Now, even if you do in that context, and you have that when people cohabitate. In other words, when you have a couple that's cohabitating, and then one who owns the house doesn't want the other to live in there anymore, the issue is, or you invited guests, or you cohabitating, and a lot of times, or in different words, shacking up. Then, if it's determined that was their residence, and that was an intent to stay there, then you might have to go through an eviction proceeding. Where in the eviction proceeding, you would have to post a notice. You'd have to it be presumably a month-to-month lease. You post a notice. They got 5 days to get out. If not, you go in there and you file a petition, you know, eviction proceeding, which might take an extra 45 days to get them out. So that's, you know, so that's a question of fact. The domicile law, as you refer to, could be used to substantiate that person's argument that I live here and I have an arrangement here. I basically have an unpaid month-to-month lease arrangement here, and you can't just throw me out. You have to go through an eviction proceeding.
Okay, because there was two homeless people I took in. And
I finally
took them out. They finally left.
And
it took some time for them to get out of here.
Yeah, and that's the problem. But thanks for the call. We got to go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers, Cinceri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief time out. We're back. Let's go to Chuck's got a question. We got about a minute. By name change. Hey, Chuck, you on All Things Legal. What you got for us?
Hi. My daughter had a child out of wedlock, and she gave the name of the dad, but he's been in the picture. He hasn't been in the picture really since day one. The child's three now. Is it difficult to change the name to, like, her maiden name?
What you'd have to do, because both parents have to agree, is you'd have to file a petition for a name change and have him served. He has the right to appear, and the court's going to take a look at what's in the child's best interest.
And if he's nowhere to be found, does the time go by where they just don't look for him anymore?
If he's nowhere to be found, then they'd have to have a curator appointed to represent his interest.
Yeah, so at the court.
Curator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you can call our office at 985-624-9697.
And we'll give you more information. Yeah, we've got a hard break. Going to national news, local news. We'll be back on All Things Legal for hour number two.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.